Okay, well, I want to make sure we have time for questions from the audience, but we have one more chair here, one more person, so I've got an introduction to make. Tim McNerney is a senior engineer at Retica Systems, a venture capital-based startup that designs ocular biometric systems. He's got a master's degree from the MIT Media Lab. From conception through construction, Tim has assembled and led a talented team of engineers and designers who created the Intel 4004 35th anniversary exhibit at the Intel Computer Museum, and I hope you all go there and see that. Critical to the success of the project was the digital archaeology, a new term that obviously here at the Computer History Museum we're very interested in, those efforts to perform in collaboration with the Computer History Museum. Tim will talk about the process of reverse engineering the Intel 4004 schematics and the BusyCom 141PF calculator ROMs that led his team to uncover elegantly crafted layers of a computational system that makes optimal use of limited hardware and software. Tim.
Thank you. It's really apropos that I'm speaking here because without the Computer History Museum, we just could not have done this project. That gift that Federico Fagin talks about, that calculator relic that he donated to the Computer History Museum, contained socketed ROMs that was really the only historical artifact that we could have extracted the BusyCom software from. And so without Federico's help and without the Computer History, Dag Spicer and Salam Ismail, we just couldn't have done it without them. So we really thank you guys. It's a great place. And what can I say? The other thing that I think is just great is that, you know, how can you be talking about, you know, historical innovation only 35 years ago with the inventors all living? It's just amazing to have a living history like this. It's just great. I got interested in computers in the late 60s when I was, I don't know, maybe 6 years old. I knew I wanted a computer when I grew up and could afford a house that I could fit the computer in. I moved from Italy where I lived, to Silicon Valley, and had the fortune of being able to have access to computers. I remember fondly the husband of my French teacher who worked for Hewlett-Packard, who would bring home calculators, pocket calculators, big calculators, and lend these to me over the weekend so that I could learn how to program. And I eventually learned how to program a PDP-8 and various machines after that. I guess what would you call me in this case? I was introduced in my sort of professional hat, what I do at my job. But in this case, I'm a history detective. And it was really a very interesting journey because we didn't really know what was available. We didn't know what was in the Intel archives that could help us with this project. We never really had any idea that we'd be able to find the software for the calculator. So, you know, things started out modest. We had really no idea what kind of resources we were going to find along the way. So I did a lot of research in, you know, what the 4004 was about, who the people were, et cetera, and that really helped, know what to look for. So let me give you sort of an outline of the talk. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project and give you a little bit of historical perspective. You know, how did people do engineering back then and how did people do engineering now? It's quite different, really. Maybe a few words on the educational value of this kind of these kinds of designs, being able to go back to the vaults, go back to the archives, and have material for people to study. So what do we do? Well, I first approached Tracy Mazur at the Intel Museum with a crazy idea. I wanted to build a chip that people could see to make the invisible visible. And how would I do that? Well, you know, these chips were pretty small, 3 by 4 millimeters. The transistors, very tiny. And I wanted to make something big, you know, say this big, so that you could actually see the transistors with the naked eye. And this is what I pitched to them. I pitched to them a fully functional replica of the 4004 using discrete transistors surface mounted onto a printed circuit board about 16 by 22 inches. This is the flyover version, and all the black dots are transistors. And this is the silk screen of the original mask works, and then printed circuits underneath that. It was something that I thought I could do alone, but it turned out to take a team of about 4 or 5 people in addition to myself, software people and hardware people, electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, to make this exhibit, graphic designers, exhibit designers. It was really a collaborative effort, interdisciplinary effort. So we started by reverse engineering. I went to the Intel Museum. I went to the corporate archives, and Rachel Stewart, the corporate archivist for Intel, was able to dig up the check plots, these sort of binders with transparencies in them that have not the original mask works, but colored plots that you could sort of look at the different layers and see how they lined up. And she found the schematics. Federico and I went to the Intel archives, and it was such a fast thing. I had no idea how big these schematics were, how many there were, how many drawings there were. So Federico sits down at this table, and Rachel hands them 3 sheets of rolled up vellum, and he goes, 1, 2, 3, yep, that's all of them. And he said, see, these schematics are drawn just like the chip is laid out. And that's really something that, to me, is great about this, is that you can really look at the functional units. It's not, you know, a vast city that you don't understand. It's you can really see the functional blocks with your naked eye, well, excuse me, here on your naked eye through a microscope for the original chip. So that was great. So now we had the schematics, and eventually they found the mask works. And what we wanted the mask works for was we wanted to lay out the printed circuit board really as close as possible to the original chip. And in fact, that's what we did. We were able to, thanks to Fred Hittig, who's my electrical engineer here, he did schematic capture using modern CAD tools to capture the schematics that we had drawings of. I had 2 engineers in Canada who are really sort of software experts, Brian Silverman and Barry Silverman. Actually, Brian Silverman is known to the Computer History Museum because he helped with the PDP-1 project, resurrecting arguably the first video game, the PDP-1 Space War. And he's no stranger to reverse engineering. So we get the schematics, and Barry and Brian just eat it up. And they had no idea what to expect either. And the thing that they really enjoyed about this was that it was so simple. It's really, you know, the minimal microprocessor. Okay, anything less is not a microprocessor, and anything more is more complicated. First they started staring at the diagrams and trying to follow the traces, and then they made a simulation of it, a transistor-level simulation, which is available at our website, 4004.com. So there's an animated simulation that you can see. You can see the transistors turning on and off and the wires turning red to green, you know, logic false and logic true. And they use that to understand better how the processor worked. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, they deeply knew this design and, really had a lot of fun doing it. So when we went back to, you know, making the board, we had corrected schematics. We had schematics that, you know, we knew worked. We had designers who knew how this stuff worked. And so when Fred went to do his schematic capture, he had, you know, good schematics to work from without any kind of typos. It's worth noting that this project was done with really no CAD, essentially. There was some simulation. I don't want to talk about things that these guys can talk about, but there was some simulation tool, sort of what we might call on the spice level, that Fajin and his team used to understand, you know, how the transistors would work and what size devices to use to drive different sized buses, et cetera. But that was about it. And I think, let's see, I guess they also did, instead of using simulators the way we do today, didn't the guys at Busicom actually make some sort of discrete...
Yeah. ...for design because it was done afterwards so that they could develop the software.
Okay, so it was really...
Busicom. So it was done subsequently to the 4004 design.
Oh, okay, fine. So that wasn't really a design verification
step. It was not
step.
A design verification. It was simply a tool to allow them to develop the software.
Right, so the design verification, from what I understand, was that these guys looked over the plots made out of Ruby.
It was actually steel trap mined. You know, Shima could find any mistake that you could possibly make. It was unbelievable. So, you know, Shima was the computer-aided design.
So what Fajin is referring to is staring at small sections of the mask works. I think that they were about a meter by a meter and a half.
Much bigger.
Much bigger.
Yeah.
How big?
Oh, it was 500x. So
500x.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So see, it was 2 meters by 175, something, yeah, 150, yeah.
That's why it's great to have folks around. So anyway, yeah, so these guys didn't really have any CAD, and we did. So, you know, we were able to immediately simulate the processor and get it working, you know, small piece of software. So that was sort of the beginning of the reverse engineering effort. The other piece of the reverse engineering effort really only started when we got our hands on the software. So that's sort of back to where the Computer History Museum came. There are very few of these calculators in the world. I want someone to correct me, but my understanding is under 10. I guess there were, 600,000 of these things built, but they got thrown away or something. Old business machines just go to the scrap heap. So there aren't very many of these things, and in particular, the one that the Computer History Museum has socketed ROMs. Fajin was so kind to give me several 4001 ROMs, one that I could keep and destroy, as I put it, and four that I had to treat like, you know, sacred things. And those were the Busicom ROMs, but it turns out after I made this custom-made ROM reader that they had holes in them. They were sort of pieces of zeros that the chips were defective in some way, or maybe the storage or something like that. So we had sort of 80 or 90% of the software. We could tell something about the software, and we knew that the ROM reader was right. And then I sent Fred to the Computer History Museum with the ROM reader, and we got the actual flawless bits, which are still on display. You can't see them, but they're on display. So then, again, we have the bits. We get them back to Barry and Brian Silverman, and again, they eat this for lunch. And within a couple of months, and these guys are just working on weekends. They have day jobs. They had stared at the disassembled code, sort of figured out how it was working. Then they made a simulator where they simulated all of the hardware. Fred had traced the wiring diagram from this relic. I had photographs from a collector in Germany, Christian Bassau. He had a calculator that he had taken the front and the back side of the printed circuit board, and I made kind of an X-ray diagram of the two so you could see all the traces. So I had traced the circuit board. We had sort of now a lot of the hardware, the wiring diagram. We knew something about the printer and how the keyboard was wired up. And these guys made a simulator in Java that would let them get the calculator working completely in software. So, you know, that was, you know, absolutely indispensable when we were then going to do this in hardware. So it's just fantastic to have a team of people who are so enamored with reverse engineering. And some of the things that we found out were really that this is a nice layered design. the statement from Shima talked about interdisciplinary. Well, we have device physics, we have computer architecture. Shima came from, I think, a software background. He was really a man of many hats. And these guys all worked together, not just on their own layer. Shima helped Fajin with the design of the chip, and Stan Mazur helped with some parts of the software. They were working across a bunch of different layers all at the same time to make the minimal amount of hardware, the minimal amount of software, the minimal amount of printed circuit board. Nothing was sort of under-engineered. It was really just optimal. And part of this, I think, is because, you know, the parts were expensive. Someone's going to correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that in 1971 dollars, the 4001 ROMs were about 5 cents a byte. And if you scale that to modern dollars, that's a 20 to 25 cents a byte. So, you know, an extra ROM, that was a lot. You know, 256 byte ROM, you didn't want an extra 256 byte ROM. So talking about the layers, there was the processor layer. Then they built, stuff written in 4004 code. And what they did with this little 4004 code plus hardware, the chipset, was they simulated the machine that Busicom came to Intel in the first place. Busicom, they had a fully fleshed out design that was, you know, this calculator machine. It was special purpose, just this particular product. It used shift register memory. It had a ROM for control store. And it was a much bigger machine than the 4004 and the associated chips. They didn't want to abandon that design. And what they ended up doing was using the 4004 plus, let's call it microcode, to make a virtual machine that was now this this calculator machine. If anybody watches Doctor Who, it's, you know, the TARDIS, right? You know, on the outside, it's the size of a phone booth, and on the inside, it's the size of a TV set. So, you know, it's just a fantastic case study of layer across layer engineering. This is very different than how people do design these days. First of all, significant designs are never done by a team this small. I mean, this was a small team. We saw all of the, you know, sort of helpers and draftsmen and the like, and we don't want to discredit them, but the core of the team was four people. And that's just unheard of, right? And they did it in a very short amount of time, and they all worked together. Nowadays, as Brian Silverman likes to say, abstraction is king. And I think, you know, abstraction is great. Abstraction barriers, it gets taught at MIT, and APIs and object-oriented programming, where you're very careful about the object hierarchies, so that you don't need to know anything about the levels below. It's a black box. I can just program to the API. I don't need to know what's underneath the hood. That wasn't what was going on here. Shima knew exactly what was under the hood, and if he didn't like what was under the hood, he went back and said, I want this instruction to, scan the key, it'll decode the keyboard for me so I can save a few bytes. And they squeezed this whole calculator without the square root. Let's forget the square root for a second. They squeezed the whole calculator into 1K bytes. So this is very different than what we do these days. Gosh, we know how big programs are nowadays. One of the things that I'm really very happy that I was able to be involved in is the release of the schematics that Tracy Mazur and I worked on. It's a great way to celebrate the 35th anniversary of such a historic product, is to make the design public, at least for non-commercial use. And so now anybody can contact Intel and get digital files of the original drawings for the 4004, the mask works, and the user's manual that they can use to, you know, write a book, teach a course, study, play with. I think that we need more of these case studies, because it's just a wonderful case study. In the field of law, the cases are all out. It's an open book, right? You can go back to the cases and see what lawyers before you, if you're a student, say. You can see what lawyers did in the past. And with computer science and electrical engineering, a lot of stuff ends up being In filing cabinets, sometimes it gets thrown out, like the HP 9100. All those engineering drawings were thrown out when they moved to when HP Calculator Division moved to Corvallis, Oregon. Lost. We have the Computer History Museum has a 9100, but there aren't any drawings. So you know, I will leave you now with the notion that you know, using designs like this to help our young people learn about engineering and be inspired by engineering and go into VLSI design and electrical engineering is something that I'd like to, you know, if there are captains of industry here and you have some designs in your vaults, in your corporate archives that isn't part of your core business anymore but would make, you know, just a tremendous case study, let it out of the vault. Thank you very much.